You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Soul Economy and Waldorf Education, Collected Works, Volume 303, and translated by Roland Everett. This is Lecture 13 of 16 lectures, given in Dornach on the 4th of January, 1922. When pupils reach the official school-leaving age of 14, they have already entered puberty. Teachers need to bear this in mind with great intensity, well before it actually manifests itself. We only have to look with open eyes at what is happening in the growing human being, both before and during the time of sexual maturity, in order to appreciate the importance of being prepared to meet this challenge. We have already seen during the course of our studies that up to the change of teeth, the child is an imitator, and that while there exists as yet no clear differentiation between organic functioning and the activities of soul forces, the child is inwardly given over to those soul and spiritual forces which are streaming downward from the head, forces which still work organically, permeating its entire organism. The way in which these soul-spiritual forces work together with the bodily forces is the most characteristic feature of this particular stage. In order to give you a clear description of what is happening in a young child at this time of life, I find it necessary, once again, to make use of insights gained through clairvoyant consciousness. I do so not because I believe it necessary to formulate ideas in some particular way, but simply because this may best help us to reach an understanding on the basis of all that has been presented so far. When a young child sleeps, its soul and spiritual members leave the physical sheaths, just as happens in a grown-up person, and they re-enter the body during the moment of waking. But in the case of the child, there is as yet no great difference between the conscious experiences in the waking state and the unconscious experiences during sleep. Under normal conditions, that is, if no reminiscences of what happened during the day enter the child's world of sleep, and this hardly happens in childhood, the child's life of sleep moves about in spheres lying far beyond the earthly realm. It is from these higher worlds that the active forces are drawn, which during the waking state work from the brain downward into the child's entire organism. During the second dentition, certain soul and spiritual forces in the child are released from working entirely in the organic sphere. They begin to assume an independent soul and spiritual character. Between the change of teeth and puberty, the child develops a freer thinking, feeling, and willing than was the case previously. No longer is it only an imitator, but through its natural feeling for authority, it develops the degree of consciousness necessary for it to make contact with the world. This faith in the authority of a grown-up is essential, for the outer conditions of life are not sufficient in themselves to ensure the child's necessary contact with the world. The way in which one adult confronts another, whether by verbal or by other means of communication, is very different from the way in which a child meets an adult. The child simply needs the additional support which a sense of authority can give. As a consequence, more and more experiences from the child's waking state will enter its soul and spiritual life also during sleep. And to the same extent to which earthly experiences enter its sleeping state, replacing those of the spiritual world, is the possibility given to us teachers to reach the child between the change of teeth and puberty through our educational endeavors. With the onset of puberty, an entirely new situation arises, with the effect that, fundamentally, the emerging adolescent is a totally different being from what he was before sexual maturity. In order to characterize the situation, it may be useful to refer to what was spoken of at the end of yesterday's lecture. Up to the change of teeth, it is normal for a child to live entirely within the physical body. However, if this state is extended beyond its normal time, and in later life such a situation would no longer represent normal conditions, the consequences will be a markedly melancholic temperament. During childhood, it is natural to have the kind of relationship between the soul's spiritual and physical organization which is characteristic of an adult melancholic. We must always bear in mind that what is right and good for one stage of life becomes abnormal for another. During the second dentition, certain soul and spiritual forces are freed from their previous organic activities, and they flow into what I have called the body of formative forces, or the ether body. This member of the human being is entirely linked to the external world, and it is right for the child to live in it during the time between the change of teeth and puberty. If already before the change of teeth there was an excess of these etheric forces, that is, if the child has lived too much in its etheric sheath before the second dentition, the outcome is a markedly phlegmatic temperament. However, it is quite possible for a child to have a normal and balanced relationship with the etheric body, and this is absolutely essential between the 7th and the 14th year, that is, between the change of teeth and puberty. Again, if this condition is carried over too far into later life, a decidedly phlegmatic temperament will develop in the grown-up. The next member of the human being, which under normal circumstances gains its independent existence in puberty, and which yesterday I called the astral body, the member of the human being which lives beyond space and time, is a real birthplace of the sanguine temperament. And if, during the time between the change of teeth and puberty, a child draws too much upon what should come into its own only when sexual maturity is reached, the sanguine temperament comes into being. Only with the arrival of puberty does the growing human being become inwardly mature for sanguinity. Thus, everything in life has its right or normal period of time. The various abnormalities come about if that which is normal for one particular time of life is pushed into another period of life. If you can survey life from this viewpoint, you learn to understand the human being in depth. And now, what is actually happening during the time of sexual maturity? Our considerations of the last few days have already shed some light on it. We have seen how after the change of teeth, the child is still working inwardly with those forces which to a certain degree have become emancipated soul and spiritual forces. During the subsequent stages, the child incarnates via the system of breathing and blood circulation to where, in the tendons, the muscles grow onto the bones. It incarnates from within outward toward the human periphery. And at the time of sexual maturity, the young adolescent breaks through into the external world. Only then does she or he fully stand in the world. This dramatic development makes it imperative for the teacher to approach the adolescent, who has passed through sexual maturity, quite differently from the way in which he had dealt with him or her prior to this event. For, fundamentally, the previous processes involving the emancipated soul and spiritual forces before puberty had as yet nothing to do with sex in its own realm. True, boys or girls show a definite predisposition toward their sexes, but this cannot be considered as actual sexuality. Sexuality only develops after the breakthrough into the external world, when a new relationship with the outer world has been established. But then, at this particular time, something is happening within the realm of the adolescent's soul and bodily nature, which is not unlike what happened previously during the second dentition. During the change of teeth, forces were liberated to become actively engaged in the child's thinking, feeling, and willing. Forces which were directed more toward the memory. The powers of memory were then released. Now, at puberty, something else becomes available for free activity in the soul realm. These are powers which previously had entered the rhythms of breathing and which subsequently were striving to introduce rhythmical qualities also into the muscular and even into the bony system. This rhythmical element now becomes transmuted into the adolescent's receptiveness for all that belongs to the realm of creative ideas, for all that belongs to fantasy. Fundamentally speaking, genuine powers of fantasy find their birth only during puberty, for they can come into their own only after the astral body has been born. It is this same astral body which exists beyond time and space and which links together past, present, and future according to its own principles, as we can experience it in our dreams. What is it that the adolescent brings with him when he breaks through, in quotes, into the external world via his bony system? It is what originally he had brought down with him from pre-earthly existence, and what gradually had become interwoven with his whole inner being. And now, with the onset of sexual maturity, the adolescent is being cast out of the spiritual world, as it were. Without exaggerating, one can really put it that strongly, for it represents the actual truth. With the coming of puberty, the young human being is cast out from the living world of the spirit and thrown into the external world, which he or she can perceive only by means of the physical and etheric body. And though the adolescent is not at all aware of what is going on inside him, subconsciously this plays an all the more intensive part. Subconsciously or semi-consciously, it makes the adolescent compare the world he has now entered with the world which he formerly had within himself. Previously, he had not experienced the spiritual world consciously, but nevertheless he had found it possible to live in harmony with it. His inner being felt attuned to it and ready to cooperate freely with the soul and spiritual realm. But now, in these changed conditions, the external world no longer offers such possibilities to him. It presents all kinds of hindrances, which in themselves create the wish to overcome them. This in turn gives rise to the tumultuous relationship between the adolescent and the surrounding world, lasting from the 14th or 15th year till the beginning of the 20s. This inner upheaval is bound to come, and it is well for the teacher to be aware of it already during the previous years. There may be people of an unduly sensitive nature who believe that it would be better to save teenagers from such inner turmoil, only to find that they have made themselves their greatest enemy. It would be quite wrong to try to spare them this tempestuous time of life. It is far better to plan ahead in one's educational aims, so that what has been done with the pre-puberty child can now come to the help and support of the adolescent's soul and spiritual struggles. The teacher must be clear that with the arrival of puberty, an altogether different being emerges, born out of a new relationship with the world. It is no good appealing to the pupil's previous sense of authority, for now he demands to know reasons for whatever he is expected to do. The teacher must get into the habit of approaching the young man or woman rationally. For example, if the adolescent who has been led by the spiritual world into this earthly world becomes rebellious, because this new world is so different from what he had expected, the adult must try to show him and this without any pedantry, that everything he meets in the world has had a prehistory. He must get the adolescent to see that present conditions are the consequences of what had gone before. One must act the part of the expert who really understands why things have come to be as they are. From now on, one will accomplish nothing by way of authority. Now one has to be able to convince the adolescent, through the sheer weight of one's indisputable knowledge and expertise, and by giving him waterproof reasons for everything one does or expects of him. If at this stage the pupil cannot see sound reasons in all the content given to him, if conditions in the world appear to make no sense to him, he will begin to doubt the rightness of his previous life. He will feel himself in opposition with what he had experienced during those years, which apparently only led him into these present unacceptable outer conditions. And if during his inner turmoil he cannot find contact with people who are able to reassure him, at least to a certain extent, that there are good reasons for what is happening in the world, then the inner stress may become intolerable, to the extent that the adolescent breaks down altogether. For this newly emerged astral body is not of this world. The young person has been cast out of the astral world, and he is willing to place himself into this earthly world only if he feels convinced of its rightful existence. You will completely misunderstand what I have been describing if you think that the adolescent is at all aware of what is thus going on within him. During his ordinary day consciousness, it rises up from the unconscious in dim feelings. It is surging up through blunted will impulses. It lives itself out in the disappointment of apparently unattainable ideals, in frustrated desires, and perhaps also in a certain inner dullness toward what presents itself out there in the unreasonable happenings of the world. If during this stage education is to be effective at all, and this indeed must be the case for any youngster willing to learn, then the teaching content must be transmitted in the appropriate form. It must also be a preparation for the years to come, up to the early 20s or even later in life. Having suffered the wounds inflicted by life and having paid back in his own coinage, the young person of 15 to 21 or 22 eventually will have to find his way back again into the world from which he had been cast out during puberty. The duration of this period varies, especially so during our chaotic times, which tend to prolong it even further into adult life. The young person must feel accepted again. He must be able to make a new contact with the spiritual world, for without it, life is not possible. However, should he feel any coercion coming from those in authority, this new link will lose all meaning and value for life. If we are aware of these difficulties already, well before the arrival of puberty, we will make good use of the child's inborn longing for authority in order to bring it to the stage when there is no longer any need for an authoritarian approach. And this stage should coincide with the coming of sexual maturity. But by then, the educator must always be ready and able to give convincing reasons for everything he wishes his pupil to do. Seen from a wider spiritual perspective, we can thus observe the grandiose metamorphosis which is taking place in the human being during the period of sexual maturity. It is of the greatest importance to realize that the whole question of sex becomes a reality only during puberty, when the adolescent enters the external world in the way I have described it. Naturally, since everything in life is relative, this too has to be taken as a relative truth. Nevertheless, one has to recognize that up to the stage of sexual maturity, the child lives more as a general human being, and that an experience of the world, differentiated according to whether one lives as a man or woman, only begins with the onset of puberty. This realization, which in our generally intellectual and naturalistic civilization cannot be taken for granted, will allow people who, without prejudice, are striving for a knowledge of man, a real insight into the relationship between the sexes. It also helps them to understand the problem regarding the position of women in society, not only during our present times, but also in the future. Only if one can appreciate the tremendous metamorphosis which is taking place in the male organism during voice mutation, to mention just one example, will one be able to understand fully the statement that up to the age of sexual maturity, the child retains a more general human character, as yet undivided into sexes. Other similar processes occur also in the female organism, only in a different area. The human voice, with its ability to moderate and to form sounds and tones, is a manifestation of man's general human nature. It is born out of the soul and spiritual substance which is working upon the child up to puberty. Changes of pitch and register, on the other hand, occurring during mutation, are the result of external influences. They are forced upon the adolescent from outside, as it were. They are the means by which he places himself into the outer world with his innermost being. It is not only a case of the soft parts in the larynx relating themselves more strongly to the bones, but a slight ossification of the larynx itself takes place, which fundamentally amounts to a withdrawal of the larynx from the purely human inner nature into a more earthly existence. This stepping out into the world should really be seen in a much wider context than is usually the case. Usually in people's minds, the capacity to love, which awakens at this time, is directly linked to sexual attraction, but this is by no means the whole story. The power to love, born during sexual maturity, embraces everything within the adolescent's entire compass. Love between the sexes is but one specific and limited aspect of love in the world. Only by seeing human love in this light can one understand it correctly, and then one also understands its task in the world. We may well ask, what is really happening in a human being during the process of sexual maturity? Prior to this stage, as a child, his relationship to the world was one where he first imitated the surroundings, and when, subsequently, he stood under the power of authority. Outer influences were working upon him, for at that time his inner being mainly represented what he had brought down with him from pre-earthly life. Humanity as a whole had to work upon him from without, first through the principle of imitation, and then through authority. But now, at puberty, having found his own way into humanity, and no longer depending on its outer support to the same extent that a pre-puberty child does, there rises up in him a new feeling, and entirely new appraisal of mankind as a whole. It is this new experience of humankind which represents the spiritual counterpart to the physical faculty of reproduction. Physically, he becomes able to procreate. Spiritually, he becomes capable of experiencing mankind as a totality. During this new stage, the polarity between man and woman becomes very marked. Only through a real understanding of the other sex by means of social intercourse, also in the realm of soul and spirit, is it possible for the human potential to come to some kind of realization on earth. Both man and woman fully represent humankind, but each in a differentiated way. The woman sees in humanity a gift of the metaphysical worlds. Fundamentally, she sees humanity as the result of a divine outpouring. Unconsciously and in the depths of her soul, she bears a picture of mankind, which acts as her standard of values, and she evaluates and assesses mankind according to this standard. If these remarks are not generally accepted today, it is due to the fact that our present civilization shows all the signs of a male-dominated society. For a long period of time, the most powerful influences in our civilization have displayed a decidedly masculine character. An example of this, however grotesque it may sound, can be found in Freemasonry. It is symbolic of our times that men, if they wish to keep certain matters to themselves, separate themselves off into lodges of Freemasonry. There are also lodges in which both men and women congregate, but in these, Freemasonry has already become blunted. They no longer bear its original stamp. The constitution of Freemasonry is, of course, a specific example, but it is nevertheless indicative of the male-dominated character of our society. Women, too, have absorbed a great deal of the masculine element in our civilization, and because of this, they are actually preventing the specifically feminine element from coming into its own. This is the reason why one so often gains the impression that with regard to inner substance and outer form, there is hardly any difference between the ideals and programs of the various women's movements and those of men, even to the very tone of speeches in which they are delivered. Obviously, these movements are different from each other, in as far as on the one side demands are made to safeguard women's interests, while on the other they are made on behalf of men. But with regard to inner substance, they are scarcely distinguishable from each other. Man in his innermost being experiences humanity as something of an enigma. To him it appears as something unfathomable, which poses endless questions, the solutions of which seem to lie beyond his powers. This typically masculine characteristic expresses itself in all the mysterious ceremonial with its dry and manly atmosphere which belongs to Freemasonry. This same male tendency has permeated our culture to such an extent that on the one hand the women are suffering under it, and on the other they are wanting to emulate it, wishing to make it part of their lives too. If you take a good look at modern medicine, with all its materialistic features, if you see how it fails to comprehend human nature, especially with regard to its physical aspect, so that it depends on experimentation, if you observe modern medicine, you will find there the product of a distinctly masculine attitude, however strange this may sound to you. In fact, one could hardly find a better illustration of male thinking than in what modern medicine so blatantly reveals to us. If one expounds the truth today, people tend to think that one does so merely for the sake of putting paradoxical statements into the world. Yet the reality is often paradoxical. Therefore, if one wishes to speak the truth, one has to put up with appearing paradoxical, however inconvenient this may be. While womankind lives more in the image it creates of humanity, man's experiences of humanity are more of a wishful and enigmatic kind. In order to understand this situation, one needs to become clear about one other symptom of our times, which is of particular significance for the art of teaching. When people speak about love today, they do not generally differentiate between the various kinds of love. Of course, one can generalize the concept of love, just as one can speak about condiments in a general way. But if someone puts abstract speculations about certain matters into the world, and then holds forth about them, it always strikes me as if he were talking about salt, sugar, or pepper, merely in terms of condiments. He only needs to apply such abstractions to practical life by putting salt into his coffee instead of sugar, because after all both are condiments, to realize his foolishness. Anyone who indulges in general speculations, instead of entering the concrete realities of life, commits the same folly. A woman's love is very different from that of a man. Her love originates in the imaginative realm, and it is constantly engaged in making pictures. A woman does not love a man just as he is, standing there before her in ordinary humdrum life. Forgive me for saying this, but after all, men are not exactly of the kind a healthy imagination could fall in love with. But she weaves into her love the ideal she has received as heaven's gift. Man's love, on the other hand, is tinged with desire. It is of a wishful nature. This differentiation needs to be made, no matter whether it shows itself more in an idealistic or a realistic sense. Ideal love may inspire longings of an ideal nature. The instinctive and sensuous kind may be a mere product of fancy. But this fundamental difference between love as it lives in a man or a woman is a reality. A woman's love is steeped in imagination. In man's love there is an element of desire. It is just because of this complementary character that the two kinds of love can become harmonized in life. An educator should bear this in mind when confronted with pupils who have already passed through the stage of sexual maturity. He should realize that by that time it is no longer possible to bring to them certain things which belong to the pre-adolescent stage, and that the opportunity for doing so has been missed. Therefore, in order to prevent a one-sided attitude in later life, one must endeavor to give to pre-puberty children enough of the right content to last them through the coming stages. In our times, when, fortunately, coeducation in both primary and secondary education is accepted more and more readily, so that boys and girls work side by side in order to learn how to cooperate as men and women in social life later on, it is of special importance to pay heed to what has just been said. Through it, a contemporary phenomenon, such as the woman's movement, will be placed upon a really sound and healthy basis. If we now expand these considerations by taking a worldwide viewpoint, we are led to the fundamental differences which exist between East and West, between Asia on the one side and Europe and America on the other. This difference between East and West is far greater than any other differences we may find when comparing, let us say, Europe with America. Throughout Asia, there still exist traces of ancient and wisdom-filled civilizations. Outwardly, they show all the signs of decadence. Outwardly, they may have become completely decadent, but nevertheless, this wisdom lives on like a memory. It is revered as a sacred memory to such an extent that, fundamentally speaking, an Asian cannot really understand a European, and vice versa. Anyone who is under illusions about this fact will delude themselves about the greatest historical world secret of our present times. It is a secret of special significance, not only for our present times, but very much so for the future. Despite its manifold complexities, life in the West bears a more uniform character than life in the East. The Western people's main concern is life in this earthly civilization, a civilization which draws its ideas, above all, from what happens between birth and death. The people of the East, at least as far as their inner religious lives are concerned, do not limit their outlook to their earthly time between birth and death, to life in the outer mechanical civilization. The man of the West, however, does live for this earthly time, also as far as his religious feelings are concerned. The man from the East asks himself searching questions, such as, "Wherefore was I born into this world? Why did I enter this sense-perceptible world at all?" The Westerner takes life in the physical world more or less for granted, even if he should end it by committing suicide. He takes earthly life for granted, and only because it would be a source of dissatisfaction and disappointment to him if this earthly existence were to be entirely wiped out through death, has he developed an inner receptivity for a belief in life after death. There is a fundamental difference between these two outlooks, but again, we shall not get to the bottom of it merely by characterizing it abstractly, instead of entering life in its fullness. The further we move from the east toward the west, the more do we find that the Western woman, despite all her outward consciousness, cherishes a longing for the spirituality of the East. The man of the West, however, presents a totally different picture. He, too, has his secret longings, but not for something vague and misty. His longings spring from what he is inwardly experiencing. From cradle to grave, he is enmeshed in the activities and pressures of his civilization. But something in him longs to get away from it all. This mood of soul we can perceive in all civilized countries around us, from the River Vistula in Eastern Europe, through Germany, France, Britain, right across the American continent, even to the shores of the Pacific Ocean. In all these lands do we find this common attribute. The educator who has to deal with adolescents experiences it too, perhaps to his despair, and without realizing the underlying causes. Only a teacher wearing blinkers could possibly overlook it. During our previous meetings, I already mentioned that really one ought to throw away all school textbooks, because only the direct and personal relationship of teacher to pupil should work upon the child. But when it comes to teaching adolescents, all available textbooks, and for that matter almost our entire outer civilization, become one great source of pain. I know that there are many people who are unaware of this because they do not enter real life with sufficiently open eyes. But here, again, in this outer civilization, we find a marked and one-sidedly masculine character. Any book on history, on the history of civilization or anthropology, will confirm this trend. As representative of Western civilization, man longs to escape from the physical world in which he is caught up, but he lacks the courage to do so. He cannot find the bridge from the sense-perceptible world to the spiritual world. And so we find everywhere in our civilization a yearning to get away from it all, and yet at the same time an inability to act accordingly. It is hard enough to achieve the right outer conditions for teaching children of pre-puberty age. But anyone who has to teach adolescents could almost feel helpless because the means available for meeting their needs are so totally inadequate. This fact alone should kindle a real longing in their teachers for deeper insight into the human being. This longing may, of course, be there already in teachers of younger children, but it is a prerequisite for anyone of sound pedagogical sense who is teaching adolescents. A woman's nostalgia for the ways of the East and a man's wish to free himself from the bondage of Western life represent a fundamental feature of our times. This differentiation between the sexes is less apparent in pre-adolescent children, who still bear more general human features. Yet as soon as we are confronted by adolescence, we meet the resulting difficulties quite concretely. Let us assume, for example, that a teacher of German literature wanted to recommend a book about Goethe, as seen from a German point of view, to an adolescent pupil. He really would find himself in a quandary, for there simply are no suitable books on the market. If he chose one of the available ones, his scholar would not gain the right picture of Goethe. If he chose a biography of Goethe written by, let us say, Luz, a German scholar, would learn to know the more outward features of Goethe better than from any of the German books on the subject. But again, he would not become acquainted with the specifically German characteristics of Goethe. This is the general situation today, for we simply do not have an adequate literature for teaching adolescents. To remedy this situation, everything will depend on the women taking their proper place in our cultural life. They should be allowed to contribute their specifically feminine qualities, but at the same time they must be careful not to introduce anything they have adopted from our male-oriented civilization. During the 90s of the last century, I once had a conversation with a German suffragette. She expressed her views in radical terms, but I could not help feeling that instead of enriching society with what only womanhood can give, she was trying to force her way into our one-sided masculine culture by employing similar masculine tactics. What is meant here must not be taken in a Philistine or prejudiced way. I felt that I had to tell this free and uncompromising lady, quote, "Your movement does not yet offer what the world really needs. The world does not need ladies who wear the trousers. Forgive me, I believe that such a remark is unforgivably rude in England, but that both masculine and feminine qualities make their specific contributions toward the general enhancement of our society." Close quote. Whenever we as teachers approach the growing human being, we must be aware of the striking contrast between pre-puberty and post-puberty years. Let us take a concrete example. There is Milton's title Paradise Lost. It would be good to use it in our lessons. The question is, when? Those of you who have thought over what has been said so far, and who have understood my remarks about the right time of introducing the narrative and descriptive element, will find that this work by Milton, as all epic poetry in general, would become suitable material after the 10th year. Also, Homer will be appreciated best if taught between the 10th and the 14th year. On the other hand, it would be premature to use Shakespeare as study material already at this stage, for in order to be ready for dramatic poetry, the pupil must at least have entered puberty. To absorb the dramatic element at an earlier age would mean that the pupils concerned would have to drive something out of themselves prematurely, something which later on they would definitely miss. What I tried to indicate just now can be experienced vividly. If one has to give, for example, history lessons to boys and girls after their entry into puberty, both masculine and feminine forces were at work during the actual historical happenings, though in a different form from that of today. Yet all historical accounts available for teaching adolescents bear a decidedly masculine quality, as if they had been compiled by Epimetheus. Girls who have reached sexual maturity show little inclination toward such an approach. Boys might find it somewhat boring, but in their case, it is not impossible to use this Epimethean way, which is one of judging, of holding on to what can be ascertained and established. But there is also a Promethean way of looking at history, which does not only record the events that actually occurred, but which shows their metamorphosis into ideas current at the present time. This latter approach to history shows how impulses which led the past have become current ideas of the present, and how impulses, in turn, continue to lead present times further. This Promethean way of looking at history appeals especially strongly to the feminine element. However, it would be very one-sided to teach history in the Promethean style in a girls' school and in an Epimethean style in a boys' school. The minds of the young men would simply flow back into past times to become even more rigid than they are already. If only the Promethean way of teaching history were to be applied in a girls' school, the pupils would feel tempted to fly off into futuristic speculations. Everywhere they would feel attracted to those impulses for which they happened to have a natural liking. We will achieve a more balanced social life only if we add to the Epimethean way, which up till now is practically the only one available, also an historical outlook bearing the prophetic marks of Prometheus. Then, if both attitudes are alive in our lessons, we shall at last achieve the right approach to history for pupils who have reached the age of sexual maturity. The end of Lecture 13.